Welcome to Deeply Disturbing Things,
the podcast.
I'm Macy.
And I'm Naomi.
And we're two professional counselors who like to talk about deeply disturbing things.
This is our therapy.
Welcome.
Join us.
Cheers.
We had a couple weeks off, so we're a little rusty.
I'm sorry, guys. I know you don't like it when we take time off. Cheers. We don't like it either, in all fairness. We come back, we forget everything.
It's sometimes life.
Yeah.
You know?
Gotta take some breaks.
I have a very important check-in.
Tell me.
What in the hell is going on with the Olympics?
Oh, yeah. Have you been watching Simone, the gymnastics? Oh,
just everything. Have you been watching the Olympics at all?
Yes. I watched it when I got my hair done for 4 hours.
What kind of mind fuck are they trying to pull by having everything say Tokyo 2020? It is 2021. I know this.
Wait a minute.
Have you not been watching?
I mean, I have, everything, but I did not notice that.
Everything is Tokyo 2020. Everything.
Is this going to be like the Bernstein Bears where like they're like, nope, that didn't happen?
Yeah. So they're trying to make it seem for the historical record, I think, when people go back to look at pictures, that it was in 2020. There was no pandemic. We didn't postpone them for a year. See? It was in 2020.
Look, liars!
It's on my shirt. It's liars. On the walls. It's everywhere. It's creepy and disturbing.
I did not even notice that. And they're just hoping people don't say anything or make a big deal about it.
I, of course, noticed and was like, what is this? Because, you know, I question everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, now we know, like, it's actually 2021. But in 50 years, people forget.
People do forget. And then they go, oh, it's 2020.
Yeah, it was in 2020.
And they'll count it out. They'll be like, nope, it didn't skip.
It's bizarre.
That is bizarre. Very bizarre. Wow. Britney stuff. Still,
what's the update with the Britney?
Well, they were able to get that other lawyer in, and he was like able to do more for Britney in 3 weeks than they have in the last like 13 years or more for her.
Is she still gonna have a conservator?
Well, they basically sped up the court date, so it's gonna happen sooner. Then it was supposed to be, I think, pushed off until November or December.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, so that it got brought up sooner. So, so it's movement at least, which is good.
Fantastic.
And she did get her own lawyer, so that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all about that empowerment piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. She had a lot of backlash towards, like, her sister and stuff for singing her songs at a... it was supposed to be kind of for Britney, and she sang her songs, but Britney said it was without her consent, and again, kind of using.
That's a little weird.
Yeah, it's a little weird. It's a little weird. So there's that.
I think if that's your sister, you do everything you can to make sure she does feel like she has control over her life as much as possible.
Yeah, like let her say okay or no.
Yeah, it's her songs.
Yeah, exactly. Just to jump back to the Olympics. How did you watch the whole gymnastics part with
Simone?
We've
been obsessing over gymnastics. Okay. My cute little nieces are staying with me for this past week, so they're super into the women's gymnastics. So we've been watching it all. We know all the names of everybody.
Well, that's so good.
And I really think having it postponed, because in sports psychology, you have to peak at the right time. And they were all training to compete last year. And so to have that be postponed a year.
It's like a whole mental warp.
Yeah, it puts you off your game. And plus, they haven't been competing. And competing is very different than practice, as we know.
Oh, yeah. But the way that we in roller derby get ready for the actual game, is by scrimmaging. Like, you actually have to practice.
Yeah. You need to bring in as many elements of competition into your practice as possible so that it's not different psychologically.
Mm-hmm. As competitive as possible, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's been very interesting. Like, I don't recall last time there being this many falls and this many. Like, I feel like the caliber was higher last time. I mean, that could be a false memory, but it just seems like there's a lot more falls than I remember.
Mm-hmm. No, for me as well. And they... I felt like I kept hearing the news say, like, with Simone, she had you know, there's so much pressure on her. There's so much pressure. It's too much pressure. But like, that's all I heard them talk about was her and not meeting expectations. And it's like, well, if you want that to go away, stop, like, focus on the other people. She's literally standing there to support her team. Focus on the team members who are stepping up and stop highlighting and replaying her errors over and over and over again.
Yeah, and I think that's just like the Britney Spears thing where we don't actually know what's going on. Mm-hmm. We're not in her head. We don't really know. I mean, I've seen a lot of negative stuff about her from other athletes, like that's just, you know, you perform anyway, you do your part, you're part of the team, you don't back out just because you don't think you're going to do good. But we don't know if that's what really happened.
Yeah, and she said...
she could have an unknown injury. We don't know.
And she said at the end when she was interviewed, they asked if it was a physical injury. She said, no, not really. And she does think it's more of a mental block, which I think that minimizing the mental part of sports isn't helpful.
It's all mental.
I know.
It's all a mental game.
There's mental and physical. And if the mental goes off, the physical means nothing.
Read about it in my book, Mental Toughness. For plug. Roller Derby.
You can find it on Amazon.
Amazon.com.
If you're really lucky and you listen to her podcast and you comment about this, she might sign it for you.
I might.
She might. She might not too if we forget. But
it's all the mental game. So who knows? I mean, her anxiety could have been so high that she just actually was frozen and couldn't perform.
And that's what they talked about. They had a previous gymnast talk about that process that from her perspective. And she just shared that. The mental part of being a gymnast, when you get, they call it often getting lost in the air. Because you could imagine, I mean, they're doing like 10 to 12 tricks in the air at a time, and each one has to be sequential going from the next. And if you're mentally not in the game, you're going to get lost in that sequence. Kind of like a dancer goes out and forgets that moment. I forgot what my dance was.
Spinning high above the air, you have to have ultimate focus.
Yeah.
And if you're off your game, I mean, I don't know. I think if it was me.
As a champion gymnast.
If I was an Olympic gymnast and felt like I was off my game, I think I would still compete, but I would dial back my routine considerably to keep it safe.
And that's where I'd wonder, like, do they even train for that or not? Is there a plan B?
Probably not.
It's probably all I know.
And what I was talking about with my sister today is, you know, they probably do that perfect 50 times, but then it's the one time that counts. And if you fall, like, there's your score. You're down to a 13 or a 12 or something.
So I'm really good at hitting people in roller derby. And
yeah,
you would, you would often, in a drill, say, Macy, show this thing, and that'll be the time that I just I'll be like skating up to do it, and I'll just like randomly fall for
over
no reason.
Nothing.
Just something about that added pressure means I'm going to not be able to do it. And even though like other people like look up to you for that, and that's a thing that you do all the time, and then once everyone's looking at you, it is much harder to perform. And
absolutely.
I don't even know why.
And well, that's completely the mental game right there. If it's something you physically can do and have done and then suddenly can't do, that's all psychological.
Well, and it's such a, I mean, with sports in general, your whole, it takes the whole body and mind to do something. So when I'm going in to like hit someone, I'm in the zone, I'm focusing on them, where their position is, where I'm at. And it's all happening very, very fast. Add in one dynamic of, oh, I have to get this right, or I have to show people, like, that's just like a wedge in between that process, and it just,
because then you're suddenly
anymore
in your head, and that's not where you need to be.
No,
you need to be 100% in your body.
Yeah
Mm-hmm. Well, that was my main check-in.
Yeah, the only other check-in is this super
Tokyo
smoky outside.
Yes, let me, I have
the
ratings, air quality on my home screen because I check it obsessively.
It's
gotten
smoky.
Slightly better. We're at 185, but we're still in the unhealthy
air.
And it's hot still. We're still in a heat dome.
Yeah, hot and smoky.
And having a COVID resurgence because of the Delta variant. It's a lot going on.
There's
a
lot.
I think humanity
people
is stressed.
People are trying so hard to pretend that this isn't happening right now. But this little break,
everything's fine.
This little break is a break, and guess what? It's coming back. So you can't just put your head in the sand and pretend that everything's fine and normal again. It's gonna hit again. It has hit. It has hit. It's here.
It has. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's it for me. You get to start first today. Ooh. And I'm just going to like psych people up a little bit so they listen to the end. But
why wouldn't they?
We're going to do.
Why wouldn't you listen to every minute?
I'm gonna
this amazing podcast.
Make Naomi do an experiment that she doesn't know any details about, and it involves a knife. And I know she's very scared. And I'm going to include that portion in her best bits. So also watch the best bits.
Check out those bits.
They're great. Woo! We got great bits.
All right. I'm going to talk about something that would probably fall into the creepy category. I'm going to share about fertility doctors who secretly inseminate their patients with their own sperm.
Gross. So invasive.
So invasive.
So invasive.
I mean, that's the whole thing. Like, I want to have choice about what goes into my vagina on all levels.
Oh.
Who and what?
Can I, quick side note, remember how you talked about the lady who gave birth to the bunnies?
Yeah. Mary Toft.
Yeah. I read an article about a young woman who got pregnant, had no boyfriend. Nothing. And she and her family thought that she was like swimming in water, and that because she was on her period, that something came up, and then she was pregnant with fish. And she actually had an ultrasound, and the pictures looked like a fish face. Like, it looked like a face of a fish inside of her stomach.
Was it like a human fish hybrid?
So, and there
what do they call those, chimeras?
Is it?
Animal-human hybrids?
Oh, maybe. So she was really worried about that. She did eventually find out, though, that it was a form of a cyst. That on
a fish cyst.
Not a fish cyst. Oh. Just a cyst. That grew, that made her stomach expand out, and she had to have the cyst removed.
But it had the face of a fish, that cyst.
It did, and with the sonogram. Yeah, so anyways, it made me just think back to your topic.
And I recently learned something about the female anatomy. I learned.
Please tell me, because I would like to know
the difference. Myself. I learned what a vagina actually is. I always thought it was the whole thing down there, all the bits.
Like
was the vagina, like everything.
It's a region
between. Yeah, a region.
This is
a southern region.
The southern region of the vagina
was a vagina, but that is not true.
No.
I learned that the vagina is only like the canal part.
It's the inner inside.
The inside.
Inside canal.
And the outer part is the vulva.
The vulva. So is the whole thing the vulva?
The whole outside part.
Well, I know the whole top is called the hood, correct? That's what I've heard a doctor tell me.
Well, that's the part that covers the clitoris.
Yes. And then.
But the whole outer part is the vulva. And it has parts.
So
it has like inner and outer labia.
Okay.
But the inside part, that is the vagina.
Okay.
So I've been way overusing the term vagina.
Vagina.
I've been talking about vagina when it was not my vagina.
It's just not your vagina.
It wasn't my vagina.
Okay. I'm glad we clarified that for all of our guests.
I felt like that's great. At age 50, I finally learned what my vagina is.
I hope we educated some folks today, especially some men today. If you toss out that lingo in a correct fashion, you're going to impress somebody.
Somebody.
I don't know who it is.
I don't know who would be impressed by that, but somebody out there.
I was just impressed. Like, okay. All right.
I have a love of knowledge. Okay. Let's talk about Dr. Donald Klein, fertility doctor in Indiana. That's his face.
I don't like his face.
That's his face after he got caught, so he's not happy.
He's like, huh.
He looks very caught. He's like,
His beard is so well trimmed, though.
It might have been like a court appearance look.
I mean,
you want a well trimmed beard for court.
He looks like he maintains that beard.
He might have a beard, Floby.
Oh, wait, what? Did you just make up a word?
You know what a Floby is?
No.
It cuts your hair. It's a suck cut, it's a vacuum
Excuse
cut.
Me?
and you just run it over your head and it sucks your hair up into it, and then razor spin and
sounds really dangerous.
And it cuts your hair.
I wouldn't recommend that. Do you do this to your children?
I do not.
Wait, what's it called?
A Flowbee.
How do you spell it? I need to write this down in my little...
I have no idea. Notebook. I like your notebook. It's a detective notebook.
Flowbee?
Flowbee.
Perhaps? Next year, smiley face.
I'm not sure.
Sounds like a labia and facial hair put together. The Flowbee.
In the 70s and 80s, Dr. Klein fathered more than 50 children using his own sperm in his patients. Unknowingly.
Not in his patients for waiting.
No, he wasn't patient.
In his
patient's
vagina.
He inserted into the vaginal canal of his patients. And further, probably. A little up.
Probably
further.
Up. It gets
a little further. So he would meet with his patients, you know, in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then come back in.
Never. So they're getting something.
He was out there getting some samples.
Oh, wait, okay.
Making some samples.
I think I have to say, like, I mentally imagined he had a warehouse. He store his semen somewhere.
No.
This was freshly administered.
And that's actually...
Gross.
Was his claim to fame for his fertility clinic. Was that he only used fresh samples
of his own. So wait,
well, that part wasn't advertised.
Okay, yeah, so nobody knew.
No.
Okay. This nobody was non-consensual.
Knew. This was absolutely non-consensual.
Disgusting acts by a dickhead.
Yes. He told his patients that the samples came from his medical students. And that frozen was not an option for them due to their fertility issues, because I guess there's a higher chance of insemination, baby making, if it's fresh versus frozen. Samples.
So he said it was from his med students?
Yes.
That also just seems not okay either.
Like, hey, med student, you want to go into wank off closet and come back and with this vial filled, buddy?
Like, if I signed up for med school, I would not assume that involved, like, as a man...
Spanking the monkey?
Yeah. Yeah. Which didn't happen, actually, so...
No, it was him. A lot of monkeys being punished. Or one
fell off
monkey.
And bumped his head.
Yeah. So one woman said she was overjoyed when she found out she was pregnant. But when her son that resulted from the pregnancy, Matt, was a teenager, he saw a news story about Dr. Klein and he became curious and did his own DNA test through 23andMe.
Hmm.
And the results came back that he had 13 siblings.
Oh my gosh, that's terrifying.
So his mother used the word creepy, knowing what had happened without her consent. So there's lots of half-siblings out there. Okay. So one of Matt's half-sisters talked about being worried about her whole own children unknowingly meeting a first cousin, mm-hmm. and, you know, getting married and maybe having children one day.
Mm.
Because the gene pool is not going to have a lot of variety when everybody's your relative in Indiana.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a good look, Indiana.
Yeah, so this half-sister, one of them, started the investigation all on her own. And she called him and was questioning him. And in a recorded phone call with her name's Jacoba, he asked her not to report it because he said his marriage was already on the rocks because his wife knew that he was donating samples. And his wife considered it in adultery.
Well, yeah.
I mean, do you think that, you know, that would be adultery Because he's like having sex with these
women. I don't even think it's like an adultery or not adultery. It's the like, am I going to be pissed off and like you're outside
in the doghouse?
In the doghouse. Doghouse. You'd have to be like the Snoopy doghouse.
Like, hubby, quit it. Quit jerking off at work and putting it in people. Like, that's weird.
Yeah, like, it's just not okay.
Yeah.
Not okay. Not okay.
Not okay. So, Jacoba and five other of the Pfaff siblings, they went and confronted Dr. Klein. They had a face-to-face, and he admitted to using his sperm, but he said he felt he was helping the women because they really wanted a baby. And he also said he felt pressured because he didn't always have fresh sperm on hand at the clinic. And then he also quoted his favorite Bible verse, which is, "Before I formed you in your mother's womb, I knew you." So I'm feeling like there was a little bit of a God complex going on. If that's his favorite Bible verse and he's creating all this life that is from
him. I mean, and that beard.
And that well-shorn beard. Yeah. One of the women who was inseminated by Dr. Klein more than a dozen times over a five-month period said in an interview, "I feel like I was raped 15 times." So there's that clear violation. Like, it's crossing a line, feeling personally violated.
Yeah, no, I could instantly imagine myself flying into the office. Like, I found out on the phone or something, and I go into his office, and I'm, like, jumping across the table, like, curse words. I'd probably try to, like, punch him, probably. Yeah. I'd be violent.
And, you know, you have the baby. Of course, you're going to love the baby, but it's not the baby you were expecting.
Well, yeah, to me, it wouldn't even be about the baby. It would be just the clear respect violation. The trust that, like, you'd given to him as your medical doctor.
It's a total betrayal of that trust that you have in a power figure. It's a power play.
Power play.
So Liz White, Matt White's mom, said that Dr. Klein's office was decorated with photos of babies he'd helped conceive.
And children.
She said, yeah, that she didn't really note it at the time as being unusual, but later it was super upsetting to think about that. Like, he's like gazing upon all his children all the time. Dr. Klein was on the Dr. Phil show.
Of course he was.
One of our past topics. And it was discussed that, you know, he had this high success rate because of the fresh specimens. So initially, Dr. Klein denied the allegations, but eventually did plead guilty to obstruction of justice charges, but he served no jail time. So the obstruction of justice charges was just because he lied at first and said he didn't do it.
Okay, but why no jail time?
Because he didn't have a criminal history and they didn't think he was likely to reoffend.
Okay, but like if we think about actual, I'm thinking of like treatment of people in mental health institutions where violations like that happened to people. That was a crime.
It wasn't a crime. That was the problem.
But it was a crime.
It wasn't a crime.
But it's a crime.
It was unethical, but it wasn't illegal to do that. What he did. Isn't that shocking?
I'm not okay with that.
The only thing they could charge him with was when they asked him if he did it, he lied at first and said no. So it was obstruction of justice. That was it.
What a huge gap. That's horrible.
Huge gap. He did surrender his medical license.
Because he didn't rape them.
Right.
However, he raped them.
So the Indiana law at the time didn't specifically prohibit fertility doctors from using their own sperm.
Well, because I'm sure it's a line in there now.
Yeah. So these siblings, they worked very hard to advocate to get the laws changed. So to make it not only unethical, but illegal.
It's just unfortunate that like when it comes up, you have to go by what is currently law, even if it's wrong and old and outdated, like we talked about with
like red domestic violence stuff too.
Yeah, and I was thinking like redlining. Oh, the redlining. How come we can't go to the case with current level of understanding of where we are as a society and culture and human decency and say, actually, just because this wasn't law before, we're going to look at this, we're going to bring in experts, and we're going to reevaluate and charge you the way that is appropriate for our times now.
Yeah. But they don't. They go on the current but why? Laws.
But why? I mean, but yes.
And it takes a lot of work to create new legislature and all that. It's a big old process.
Yeah, I know. It's wrong.
I have some Schoolhouse Rock videos that just popped in my head explaining that. It's a bill. It's a bill. It's an ordinary bill.
Ow, sorry. I got excited.
So the half-siblings did work very hard. And as of 2019, a new law was passed into Indiana that made fertility fraud a felony. So as of 2019, there was about at least half a dozen siblings in central Indiana alone, but a lot more because you only know who's done a DNA test and is in the system. Mm-hmm. So there could be a lot more. But as a positive note, some of them have really bonded and they do reunions and they That's really good. Feel like siblings.
Yeah, I mean they're people now.
So his case is just one of several that have been uncovered because we have DNA testing at our fingertips now.
Mm-hmm.
In Texas, after finding out her biological father was her mother's fertility doctor, a woman named Eve is advocating for a bill that would make a doctor using his own sperm criminal sexual assault. So she's Good. Taking it to that level where this is an actual physical sexual violation.
And this reminds me when we talked about the gymnast trainers.
Oh, Nasty Nassar. The doctor.
Yes, yes. Not Mr. Nasty Nassar doing like the very inappropriate screenings on the girls where he just medically justified why he had to do it. But it was sexual assault on a minor.
Yeah. And
all their authority.
Another power play.
Yeah, your authority, your degrees mean nothing when you abuse it.
Nothing.
Get out of here.
I think it shows you actually have no power.
None.
You're weak.
We respect you none.
You have nothing. You mean nothing. You weak, are nothing.
Weak man. With your old beard. It's all you got. You got a well-trimmed beard. I'll give you that.
And a look of guilt. Take that to the bank, Dr. Klein. So that bill has passed the state Senate in Texas. So that's cool.
Get it, Texas.
And there are also ongoing lawsuits in Idaho, Vermont, California, Canada, and the Netherlands, wow. All brought by former patients or their children against doctors accused of using their own sperm.
Wow. I mean, you got to think about like the psychological part of that. Like at what point does that doctor go, I'm just gonna put it in them,
I'm gonna go step out of the room,
yeah, that's
make
like
a sample,
it's intent, right?
Make a freshie.
If this was murder, right, like the planning level of this,
it'd be first degree
yeah. Because they didn't just slip it in. They didn't slip on the mopped floor and drop right. Their semen into the vaginal canal.
They weren't
canal.
Just wanking off, you know, walking by while the lady was laying there and some accidentally fell in.
Great aim. I mean, try to defend it in court. Why not? But it's unlikely.
Not aerially transmitted like the COVID.
It's not just an open hole either. This isn't, what's that game? Cornhole?
It's not cornhole. Okay. No. It's not tiddlywinks either.
It's tiddlywinks.
You don't know Tiddlywinks?
Tiddly? Like,
it's a game.
Like tiddly?
Tiddly with T-I-D-D-L-Y. Winks. Tiddlywinks.
I figured it out. It's a racer on the end.
I was an eraser. Macy had a delivery of pens from the Tokyo Pen Shop today. And we're nerding out about it a bit.
I love it. Sorry, what'd you say?
Tiddlywinks.
Tiddly.
There are these little
is it
plastic
tiddly.
T-I-D-D-L-Y. Tiddlywinks. Winks. I had a set when I was little.
Wink.
Wink. They're little plastic colored discs, and you kind of like use one to pop the other into a receptacle of a kind.
Wait, what? Like sperm into a vaginal canal?
No.
What is a tiddlywink? I don't understand.
I'll show you later.
Is this generational?
I don't think that anybody plays it now. It was in the era of pickup sticks and
I had
barrel
pickup
of monkeys
sticks
and whatnot.
And barrel of monkeys and mousetrap.
This was in that era.
Okay.
So apparently you were deprived of the winks.
Tell me about it.
You were not tiddling.
You tiddled with the best of them.
I tiddled by myself, sadly. I'll just stop there. I was about to say something.
You should keep going.
No.
This is what happens when we don't meet for 2 weeks. There's no rules. I'm crying.
So I became interested, as I do.
Late night YouTube session.
In donor insemination, like this whole world. So I did a little side research.
I bet you did.
So donor insemination is when people, individuals or couples use donor sperm when the person with sperm in the relationship either doesn't have sperm or has very poor sperm analysis. And it could also be if there's a genetic problem that might be inherited from the person with sperm.
Okay.
So that's when it's used. There's an American Society of Reproductive Medicine that has sperm donor guidelines, and they say there should only be 10 births per population of 800,000 from the same donor.
Okay. So is that why they take, is that why there's
that
limits? Yeah.
Or else there's not enough variety in the gene pool. And you end up like the Royals in the UK. Not to just offend our UK listeners.
Cold.
But, you know, if everybody's first Rainy. Cousins, it gets a little iffy.
Oh.
You know?
I hadn't thought about that.
It's like, you know, with too much first cousin action, it's no bueno. So if you have a whole bunch, like in Indiana there.
I can only relate it to, like, dog breeding.
So,
if you cross dog breed.
Dr. Klein made at least 50 kids, and they're all living in that same area, largely, unless they moved away. So the chances of meeting a relative are very high in that area.
Yeah. And if they have a mustache and you're into mustaches, it might be hard to say no.
I have to say, it's very good that Dr. Klein made cute babies.
Are they cute?
Yeah, they're all good looking folks. So
that's good. That is.
I mean, not to overvalue looks.
And not to diss on not cute
unattractive
babies.
People, but I mean, that's the society we live in. So it'll make it easier for them to succeed just because that's our society.
Yeah.
So I looked up a sperm bank in Washington, our state, the Seattle Sperm Bank.
Yeah.
And they limit to a maximum of 25 families per sperm donor. So that's even less than those national standards.
Okay.
And that's in the entire U.S. because they ship their sperm out all over the place.
Always had this when I was younger. When I was younger, getting paid very little, working a ton, I was like, I could donate eggs and make them, like, there's a decent amount of money.
You make a lot of money. It's like 10 or 20,000 or something, right?
Yeah, I think it was like 17,000 when I looked, especially back then.
That's
like
a lot of coin.
Yeah, and
but
then
you have
I
to qualify. There's a lot of stipulations.
Yeah, there was. I remember, I read through all the steps. I'm like, I'm going to do this. This is like a lot of money in my brain. And then I just imagined like a little me somewhere. And as an only child, I couldn't have that.
And like
there can only be one.
Accidentally running to them at the grocery store and then glare at them.
No, I'd have to smother them with a pillow. There can only be one.
There can only be one.
There can only be one.
See, I had a sibling, so I learned to share.
I don't. I will put you out.
So I looked up being a sperm donor with the Seattle Sperm Bank.
Mm.
You can earn up to $5,000 every 6 months just for doing something you do all the time anyway.
Yeah.
I and love it that does, kind of money.
And it does help people. It really does. It does. When it's consensual and you say, I want a sperm donor, not your creepy doctor.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, because, you know, infertility issues are very painful for people.
It is.
So you are helping. So here's the donor requirements. You have to be between age 18 and 39.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be healthy. So I'm sure that means like...
Do lots of scans.
You're exercising, good diet.
Good BMI.
No, probably like heavy alcohol drug use. You have to be a current student or a young professional. So they want successful people. Either successful now or on the way to success.
Interesting.
Because if you're a person that is buying a vial of sperm, you kind of want to have a little bit... This is kind of like that maternal impression.
Yeah, I was going to...
Like,
I
you want to have that... A little
kind of bordering swaying, some eugenic-y conversation like, here.
A little designer baby-ish. I mean, like,
because what is like me having a PhD have anything to do with my future offspring?
Nothing.
I was going to say it literally is nothing because I could have honestly gone either way.
No, it doesn't.
I could have ended up living with my dad my whole life. And I actually probably would have been fine with that.
Yeah.
I would have been happy.
I mean, you really don't know, but I think that that's...
It's like a selling point.
This is what future parentals are interested in. You know, they want to know, like, oh, they're doing this with their life. Because maybe it's an interest that matches theirs. Like, oh, they're a graphic designer, and I am also an artist.
I mean, I can see that side a bit more. Like, because it is such a loss that you're feeling and to feel connected somehow with that process. I get that side of it for sure.
But I mean, yeah, there's nature, but nurture's out there. The wild card of nurture.
Mm-hmm.
You also have to be legally able to work in the US and able to commit to 1 to 5 hours per month of the work.
1 to 5 months?
1 to 5 hours a month.
Oh, 1 to 5.
Donating
the
freshies.
The freshies. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which
I mean
might not even feel like work.
So and they have to think about things too that people don't report. Like
chafing?
You know, like I'm you may like my PhD, but do you like that my pointer toe is longer than my other toes? Do you like that my father said monkey toe my entire childhood? Is that what you want for your child?
No, they
do you
don't.
Want them to be 5'3"?
I think they, no, they don't want that. So from their website, there was a testimonial from Seattle Sperm Bank donor number 12500. I can't believe how easy it is. I spend a lot of time working the gig economy, Lyft, Uber Eats, dog walking, and grocery delivery. The donor program worked out great for me to get some extra spending money in between shifts. So just like popping in for a wank back into the Uber. I also didn't realize how needed donors are. I was happy to provide this blessing to couples. I feel like that part was like, did they make him say that last part?
I should say it's like at the end. He definitely talked about whacking off in between his job before he talked about that.
Yes. It's so great.
I mean, I'm so glad that
get
you
get some extra spending money in between shifts.
It's just weird. There's like
wouldn't
little.
Wouldn't you be a little tired and hungry after that?
There's just like little yous out there everywhere. Maybe this is a single child thing. I mean, my single childness with my Taurusness. I can't allow it.
I can't reconcile that.
No.
So then I looked at, let's meet the donors.
But like, what if you saw, what if you later saw like this child in a grocery store? You just have this eye contact moment of like, oh, you're
Is
mine.
That my child? Did I father that
like,
child?
Like, do you have, like, would you be able to know? I wonder if there's like a internal biological thing that's like.
Oh yeah, I could probably smell them.
That one's mine.
Or they can smell you. Yeah.
I mean, let me see your toes.
There's something there. So I looked at Meet the Donors, and it's very like a dating site.
Ooh, swipe left, swipe right. I've never done that. I just know that
I couldn't see photos because I don't have an account.
We're not cool.
But it was like a motto, number 14143. He's an open ID donor. So what this is a new program where you agree as a donor that the kids you father can contact you once they're 18.
I like that.
So it creates more trust with like, okay, this is a real person out there, not my doctor.
Yeah, no, I like that. I mean, I don't think I'd agree to it personally.
So if you don't agree to be an open ID donor now, your sperm's probably not going to get bought up on the
sperm market. Gotcha. It just adds some legitimacy.
Yes. Mm. So eyes brown, height 5'10". Hair dark brown, weight 190, tells blood type, ethnicity, mix, Asian, Caucasian, English, Filipino, German, Irish, and then says his job, AA, business communication, and military maintenance. So it's like a dating site.
Yeah, like with your blood type.
And you can pick a kid, like, if you want, that kind of might resemble you physically.
You know? To, like, have a good matchup.
Yeah, I mean, some people care about that. Some people don't care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. I mean, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This does definitely get into designer baby territory a little bit, but I think a lot of women who are going through this definitely can benefit from having a service that is there to help when they can't have their own children.
Yeah, I think it's great when it's not creepy.
I like that. I'm writing it down in my notebook.
So there was this other guy. I'm not going to like get super into his details. His name was Dr. Cecil Jacobson. He was another fertility doctor who fathered 75 children. And he was awarded, it's like a mock Nobel Prize called the Ig Nobel Prize. He was awarded the prize for scientific research in biology, and the Ig Nobel Prize cited him as Dr. Cecil Jacobson, relentlessly generous sperm donor and prolific patriarch of sperm banking, for devising a simple, single-handed method of quality control. Super witty, right? So I thought that was good.
It's great. Yeah.
Single-handed method of quality control.
I like it.
It's all in your hands. And
it's all in your hand.
It's all in your hand.
So he didn't serve like final things about him. Like he didn't actually go to jail.
No, he surrendered his medical license, but there was no way to charge him criminally because his acts were not criminal at that time. They weren't illegal.
His tiddly winks.
His tiddly winking was not illegal. Just seriously unethical.
Seriously unethical. Okay.
I'm going to let it look up tiddly winks and show you because...
You should show me.
There was fun things in the old days made of plastic.
Lots of fun things are made of plastic.
I mean, now we're all down on plastic, but...
Oh.
At one time,
Furbies.
At one time, plastic was going to save the world. It was the future.
It was.
Oh, yeah. This is what it looked like. Yeah, you have the winks.
Oh, I have not seen that. They're like brightly colored.
And then you tittle them into the cup.
I just don't like the word tittle. And winking about it seems inappropriate. Okay.
Tittle.
Would you like to be in charge of the notepad for the second part?
Sure. What am I jotting down here?
Anything that sounds fun.
Fun.
Okay. I like fun or interesting.
Oh, like a title ideas?
Yeah, that's what I do. See, I have, so far I have Flobe.
Flobe. It's a Flobe subcut.
Flobe and Tiddly Winks.
What a Flobe.
Tiddly Winks. And then I have It's Great When It's Not Creepy.
I don't remember saying that.
You said it.
I have no memory of that.
All right. All right. All right. You ready for my topic?
All right.
Yeah. Okay. Don't look at my stuff.
I'm only looking at myself in the video.
Good. You should do that. All right. So I'm gonna talk about phantom limb pain.
I know all about this.
I know. So you'll have good conversation.
I'm so like about to nerd out hard. Good. Nerd cape on. Do this.
Okay. Why do you know so much about
this? I'm gonna
this?
Get us nerd capes.
Can we?
And we can put them on at the appropriate time, like now.
I still want. I still want our cult to happen. With our
Alethea.
We had a website idea. We got really into this for a period of time. We like actually hung out specifically to talk
about it. Sorry. We did.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I'm going to talk about phantom pain. This is something that honestly I've heard about. I've heard about in the trauma world. I knew little tiddly bits about this.
And not a tiddly bit.
A tiddly bit. So you're pretty knowledgeable though?
In a certain realm of it, I am sort of knowledgeable. Like,
okay, like you can chime in as we go.
A low middle class amount of knowledge.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds like more than when I started.
Okay.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about this one because honestly, I didn't fully understand it, just to be completely honest. I knew that people would feel pain in limbs that were no longer there, maybe from amputation, something like that.
I'm feeling super ADHD right now. I'm sorry.
What's going on? Why did you just grab the paper aggressively and look at me?
Because I'm like, I have to leave the room and come back.
Why?
But I don't think that's...
Why?
Because it's not at all what you're talking about right now. I'm like subject jumping too far.
Like you're wanting to talk about
it? No, you made me think of something, but it's like 10 degrees of separation from what you're talking about. Synesthesia. Remember
synesthesia? Oh, yeah. Synesthesia. Yeah.
Yeah. I forgot to mention in my check-in that my niece has it. I just discovered last night.
Oh,
and I
really
thought it'd be fun to bring in her and have her explain like her experience.
How about we do that at the end?
Okay.
Okay. Sounds good. That's fine. See, it's good. Okay. So I first started like just kind of Googling and I got the same basic knowledge that I already had when I just did like Google search. So I actually like looked up an article, and that was probably the most current.
Yo, articles.
Articles. Peer-reviewed articles.
Read beyond the abstract.
Yeah. I don't know why we did so much air pumping.
That was a lot of air pumping. That was very aggressive.
Cite your sources.
Cite your sources.
Speaking API of, style. This is articles from Bish News, Subedi, and George Grossberg. I don't know, like, how much is too much?
I think you've entered that realm.
Okay. All right, so here we go. I'm going to share a little bit more knowledge about it, first of all, for kind of where we're at right now, and then I'm going to actually back up to the Civil War.
Walk it back. Love it.
Walk it back because
that's how that looks.
Because I'm gonna walk it back because what I ended up walk it back
walk
and
it back.
What I found, what I found out.
Everything has become an interpretive dance suddenly. It's been too long since we met. That's the problem.
I know. I
it's
missed
pent up.
You.
It's all pent up.
Let's dance. All right. So, first of all, this probably isn't a laughing matter. But
the Civil War is for sure not a laughing matter. Let's get serious. Crime.
All right, I'm back. The concept of phantom limb pain as being the pain perceived by the region of the body that no longer is there. And it was first described by Ambrose Pare, a 16th century French military surgeon. Silas Weir was a famous Civil War surgeon who later actually coined the term phantom limb pain. So that's why I found this, read about where we're at currently, and then I wanted to go back.
Are you going to make a mirror box later? Is that what you're doing? But with a fucking knife? That is mean.
I
just put it all together, all the pieces.
You mean the box separator over there, the giant butcher knife?
Well, you brought in a bunch of stuff. I was like, what is all that?
And the paintbrushes.
And then you asked for a knife and... Oh. You know I'm psychologically vulnerable.
That's why this is the funnest. Everything. Safe space. So, okay. So I read that and then kind of it honestly just drops that there. So I picked it back up later. But a recent study estimated that there were about 1.6 million people with limb loss in the U.S. in 2005. And this number was projected to increase by more than double, 3.6 million by the year 2050.
Is a lot of it military related?
A big chunk of it is, but there's also many things like work-related industrial accidents, let alone just regular accidents.
Balloon accidents.
Gender reveal parties.
Fucking gender reveal parties.
Yeah. Kind of lose an arm in those things. So vascular problems, trauma, cancer, congenital limb deficiencies are some of the common causes of limb loss. The number of traumatic amputations has also increased since the beginning of the conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. The incidence of phantom limb has been reported to range from 42.2 to 78.8% in patients actually requiring amputations. So it's been drastically increasing for the amount of amputations needed. So stump pain is described as the pain in the residual portion of the amputated limb, whereas phantom sensations are the non-painful sensations experienced in the body parts that aren't there anymore. So stump pain, and I actually didn't know this difference, honestly, when I prior to looking this up. So I had just heard of phantom limb pain, but stump pain is also really significant because those nerve endings have already healed. Like this wound has been healed and they're experiencing significant pain in the actual stump portion as well. Super added phantom sensations are touch and pressure like sensations that are felt on the phantom limb from objects such as clothing. So it's really interesting. So if you're wearing like a long sleeve shirt and you've been, say, amputated at the elbow, you may actually feel sensations of fabric on your arm or your hand that are no longer there. So some of the risk factors for this include, as far as statistically speaking, female sex actually had a higher correlation of having phantom limb pain. Thought that was interesting. Upper extremity amputations are more likely to have phantom limb pain.
I wonder if the female part is because they have higher levels of empathy.
Maybe. Presence of pre-amputation pain was also linked. So people who had a lot of pain prior to amputation. And then residual pain in remaining limb also, and then time after amputation. So the length of time would also have an impact. So larger population studies are needed. And this is what really surprised me, like going back to the Civil War to now, is like we have a lot of options for treatment, but we still don't have like a concise, here's what's going on. We kind of have like, here's 10 things that might be going on. And I mean, that's some progress, but really not where I expected it to be by now. There can be a lot of different presentations of this. So I know we hear phantom limb, which we think arms, legs. However, it can also include body parts like the eyes, teeth, tongue, nose, breasts, penis, bowels, and bladder. But the most common occurrence is with limbs. Phantom pain and sensations may have its onset immediately or even years after. So there may be a period of time where they don't have phantom limb and then it occurs years after the amputation. So some of these things that may come up could be tingling, throbbing, piercing, pins and needle sensations. Those are some of the most common. And the rate of phantom pain or sensation was not reported to be higher in people with bilateral limb amputations. So basically, if you had both amputated, it didn't like make that worse compared to one being amputated. The presence of pre-amputation pain was reported to increase the risks, and it's likely that stress, anxiety, depression, and emotional triggers can exacerbate.
Wow. Exacerbate.
It's because you talked about masturbating earlier.
I never said masturbate. I believe I said spanking the monkey.
You did. Exacerbation.
You interpreted in your own mind masturbate.
The exacerbation of phantom limb pain. Okay, so, but I do want to say that, so a study found that amputees with depressive symptoms were more likely to characterize their pain as more severe as than those with depressive symptoms. But in all of these, like, identified, like, what causes phantom pain, actual psychological reasons have not really been founded. There's not enough research to show that that's actually a correlation.
Did you say those with depression, they experience it more or less?
More. More likely to characterize their pain as severe. So it doesn't mean that it causes phantom limb pain. No.
That's not what I think at all.
What do you think?
No. I was just trying to fit that into what I've studied.
Well, tell me. Jump in because as relevant.
Depression.
Yeah.
We know there's a nipping of neural connections, right?
Yes.
So I'm wondering if that is somehow... Do you need a refill? Is that your signal? Ringing the bell of the mostly of the cab. Do you want the same one?
No.
So I'm wondering how that might relate. If you have less neural connections, if they're... What you do have is more isolated, like if that could connect.
Well, and we do also know that depression can exacerbate things like chronic pain.
Right.
Reports of chronic pain.
Yeah, that's, I mean.
So somatic symptoms too.
You feel just more vulnerable.
You
just feel
more sensitive. Fragile.
Yeah. I'll get you another.
Thank you.
Bevy.
Thanks. So I just want to make clear the difference that it's not necessarily saying it's being caused by it, but that it can exacerbate the symptoms or potentially make it feel worse, like the severity gets worse. So originally, though, this was thought to be primarily a psychiatric illness. With the accumulation of evidence from research over the past decades, it was really pushed as a psychological problem or issue because they didn't have a... You know, when they're looking, say, at stump pain and they're looking at that area, there's no wound. There's no medical reason why it should be hurting. And I think that really confused the medical profession. So it was kind of easier to say, well, must be psychological, which creates problems because it starts to minimize people's pain when they're told it's psychological versus physical. It makes it somehow sound like it's not justified. But again, that's not actually the thing here. So other things that might be going on, things like central neural mechanisms that are being impacted. I'll talk about that here in a second. And there's some other theoretical constructs that may be impacting this. So one of them is peripheral. So during amputation, the peripheral nerves are severed. So this is just, so say if you lost an arm, the nerves at that end are severed. This results in massive tissue and massive tissue injury that causes a disruption from the normal pattern that the nerve inputs go to the spinal cord. So this, sorry, you always come back in.
Can you do a recap?
I was just saying, it used to be primarily thought as psychological, but that's not the case.
No.
Okay. So, and then I just said there's peripheral damage. So during amputation, the nerves are, when they're severed, it actually creates a neural injury that disrupts the pattern and path to the spinal cord. So this is followed by a process called deafferentation, and the proximal portion of the severed nerve sprouts to form like these neural pathways that are new. So it kind of creates these new neural pathways that are now processing information differently. And these actually collect molecules that are expressed as sodium channels, and it creates these spontaneous discharges within these sodium channels within the neural pathways. So this does get a little complicated here, but just know.
I love neuroscience.
Yeah. So
I
like,
fangirl about neuroscience.
Yeah. So in those, well, this is nervous system, but
oh,
that's okay. So your nerves.
That's good too.
Your nerves have these sodium channels that get these hype excitability and spontaneous discharges that they say could be a potential
that
source.
That word sounds related to my topic.
Of stump pain. Yes, it does. Spontaneous discharges. Write it down in the notebook.
Oh my gosh, I'm slacking on my
you
note.
You are.
Note taking.
Yes. So it could be a potential source of stump pain, including phantom pain. So studies have shown that when they use drugs that block sodium channels, it actually helped reduce some of those symptoms. So it does help support this theory in some way that it reduces some of the phantom limb. But another thing, so this actually creates changes at the level of the spinal cord when you have a limb amputated. This one gets pretty complicated, so I'm just going to highlight here. Some neurons in the areas of the spinal cord that are not responsible for pain transmission sprout and create into what they call a dorsal horn at the spinal cord, and it creates this transmission input. So this level at the spinal cord is being changed, and they call it a wind-up phenomenon where there's an upregulation in these receptors. So we know that neurons, the first one is like neurons at the source create new sodium channels that communicate with the spine differently. This one is saying that the actual level at the spinal cord is winding up. It is becoming upregulated in those receptors. So almost like more hypervigilant to those responses. Okay. There's also changes in the brain because of this. So when you lose a limb, actually maybe the better way to say this is your mind creates maps, right?
Mind mapping, yes.
Mind maps.
And your mind will remap.
Yes. So that's called reorganization, cognitive reorganization. So when you lose a limb, your brain has to go through this process of reorganizing the mapping process. And so a lot of research is looking at this, that's saying that maybe the reorganization is not, you know, it's not necessarily linear.
It's absolutely not.
Yeah.
That's why you might feel your penis in your elbow. That stuff happens. Because it's just going to remap to what's nearby.
Yes, yes.
You've seen that homunculus thing, right? With the sensory motor map, where like how much of the brain is dedicated to how much where you feel the most stuff. Like the lips are huge on it. And
oh.
Have you seen that thing?
No, I haven't seen the homunculus. Yeah. Write that word down. Cortical reorganization partly explains why the stimulation of neurons within a stump or surrounding area produces sensation in the missing limb. Basically, your brain mapping still is perceiving the arm as being there. And the experiment that we're going to do later is going to model that. Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is the homunculus. So it's showing the
that's terrifying. Will you post that on the Facebook page?
Yeah, like where we feel things in relationship to the brain and mm-hmm. Where they are next to each other as well, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. also by how much. So you see where our hands are very sensitive,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. eyes, a lot of information, nose, lips are huge, tongue.
Mm-hmm.
But you also can tell like the toes and the genitals right next to each other.
Yeah, interesting.
So if you perhaps lose some toes,
you may feel it in your
penis. You might feel it in your ween.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is totally the same concept.
Yeah.
And they have done multiple imaging studies on the brain to see that there is a greater involvement in that cortex areas with intense phantom
that might also explain toe fetishes people have by the way. Oh,
yeah, like sensual like people touches. That like
to suck toes or it, have their toes sucked.
I mean,
I am not one of those people.
That's okay.
I don't like to suck toes but or have my toes sucked. I'm not judging.
But we don't judge.
No.
It's next to your penis, so it makes sense.
The genitals, so also the vulva and the vagina.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Which are different, as we've learned tonight.
Sure. So, and that was actually, so the body schema concept was actually proposed by Head and Holmes in 1912. So like, this isn't new. This has been around for a long time, that there's like a neuro matrix, a neuro signature that is developed in your brain.
Is that who made the homunculus?
Maybe.
I don't know. Now I'm going to pull it back up. That sounds familiar. Holmes sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's Head and Holmes. And then there was also the neuro signature was proposed by Melzack. So maybe those guys. And then I already said, like, psychologically, it's really just not been linked from the research we've had so far. Treatment, I'm just going to show you this list. Look at this treatment list.
It's Dr. Penfield.
Totally unrelated. Sorry. Okay, but look. This is like a big, like a lot of treatments that could help. There's the pharmacotherapy medicine route. There's surgical procedure route.
Where are mirror boxes?
Theirs are actually... Oh, there it is. Yeah, I was going to say it's going to be under the adjuvant therapy.
Yeah, I've seen that work really well. Therapy. That's where my research has been with the mirror box stuff and all that.
And I read a separate article about mirror therapy, and that was really interesting where you have them actually... stand and look at themselves in a mirror where their limb is there and they're doing the movements and the limb is doing the same things that they think they're doing with the limb, the phantom limb.
Oh, I've seen it a little different.
What did you see?
Well, I'm a major fangirl for shout out V.S. Ramachandran, neuroscientist, San Diego University. So he invented the mirror box. He's done a lot of research in phantom limb stuff. And so with him, like, say you didn't have a left arm, you could put your right arm in the mirror box where it looks like it's your left arm, and then the mind is tricked. And so if you have pain in the missing left arm area, if you just massage the right arm, but nice. Your brain sees it as a left arm, and then it relieves the pain. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing.
Yeah. No, that is very similar thing, similar model. Yeah. This is saying even just the concept of them being able to see and move that limb helps alleviate.
Yeah. He's the one that invented that.
That's awesome.
So Ramachandran, if you want to be on our podcast, email us.
That would be super
deeply
great.
Disturbing things at gmail.com.
You're gonna have to fangirl email him. No one's just
I've read your books.
Email
I've
him.
Quoted you email on many him. Occasion. I've watched all your TED Talks.
Will you email him?
I will email you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. There's a ton of medicine approaches. I'm not gonna go into all of those, but there's everything from opioids to neutralize it out, antidepressants.
I just don't think that's the way to go.
Anticonvulsants. There's also when like it's ECT, TENS, the trans electrical nerve stimulation, that thing with the little, like, you put the little patches in your muscles.
Yeah, I don't think that's the way to go.
But so all of these things have shown to be helpful in outcomes in studies. So, you know,
but there's a placebo effect always out there.
Yeah. So, but really the whole conclusion of this whole paper was we don't know the exact cause, which may mean that there's multiple things going on, which is fair. But that also makes treatment more complicated because you're going to assume that it's different for everybody, right? If there's a bunch of potential causes, that probably means that people are presenting differently based on their specific trauma, which makes sense. But that means treatment is going to be very individualized.
Yes.
Okay. Are you ready to go back in time?
Yes.
To the Civil War doctor. That's him.
Civil War Silas, is very dark.
Silas Weir.
That sounds like a Mitchell. Civil War name.
Yeah.
Silas. Isn't that also the name of somebody in Courage the Cowardly Dog?
That makes sense, but I don't remember, actually. Okay, so he actually specialized in what was called ghost pain for lingering amputation pain. So in July 1866, there was a short story called The Case of George Dedlow. It appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, and it's remembered today as a vivid early description of phantom limb pain. So the narrator had lost both arms and both legs in the war. He experienced clenching, burning in those vanished limbs that cannot be soothed. Dedlow recounts, "I had begun to suffer the most acute pain in my left hand, especially the little finger. And so perfect was the idea, which was thus kept of the real presence of these missing parts, that I found it hard at times to believe them absent. Often at night, I would try with one hand to grope for the other." Mm. Though Americans had read plenty of war stories, this one actually really took a lot of public attention, and people started showing up at this hospital to try to meet Dedlow. However, that Dedlow wasn't real. Mm. This was actually this Civil War doctor's recount. He took experiences of different people that he had heard
and combined it into a story.
Yeah. To then kind of really show an account and get people like pulled into the experience, which I honestly don't think is a bad thing.
As long as you say that's what you're doing.
Which he did eventually, but there was still, I mean, news traveled a little slower back then.
By like horseback.
So people would actually show up at the hospital wanting to meet Dedlow, and there was no Dedlow. But really, the Civil War in general was just a medical catastrophe, right? Like hundreds of thousands of people dying from wounds, infections, contagious diseases that the physicians really weren't equipped to help. New front-loading rifles at the time, the bullets were known as mini balls. They allowed more accurate firing at long ranges, but it was really bad for soldiers and surgeons. What happened was it was a hollow mini ball that rotated in flight, and then it flattened on impact, shattering bones, tearing up body tissue. So it was really damaging. And in most cases, it was really hopeless to stitch someone back up together, especially because they were also like mid-battle, just didn't work. So they started doing rapid amputations.
And they had no anesthesia.
Nope. And
poor things biting on bullets, screaming, having whiskey poured down their throats. And it's just
awful.
It's so
awful,
excruciating, the whole thing.
Surgeons adapted the only way they could. They did the amputations. And today, removing a limb in less than 3 minutes sound really barbaric. But speed was the only way they could stop blood loss and prevent infection, as well as pain. On the battlefield. So that it's pretty just intense to think that's the lesser evil.
That they would pass out.
Yeah, like and not just cut it
be
off.
Be present during those situations.
Because you get gangrene, you could get massive infections, you could get what's the one where it goes up to your heart?
Sepsis,
yes.
Is that what it is?
I think.
Don't quote me on that.
I don't know. So historians estimated that surgeons had removed about 30,000 limbs by the time the fighting ceased. 30,000. There's some photos of some folks who had limbs lost.
I mean, I was a weird kid. So when I was in fifth grade.
Were you talking into the side of your mic? You know better.
I know better.
Oh, that's so much better.
When I was in fifth grade.
You're going to sound like poop the first half. All right.
I don't want to sound like poop.
I mean, you'll still be audible, but you made a mistake.
Again, I've made a mistake.
Mistakes were made.
I read Andersonville, which is a book written at that time that just goes into like all the Civil War prisons and like the conditions. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like the fields were filled with blood and families were torn apart and everything was just so brutal. I mean, not having anesthesia.
Can you imagine?
No.
Like sawing like a bone saw.
Yeah, like, I just and like here, bite on this leather strap.
Yeah, I mean, I would be praying, knock me out. Someone just punch me in the head. Punch me in the head, knock me the
It's just out. Horrific. It's just horrific times.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of the surgeons, Silas, that I mentioned earlier, was drawn to cases of nerve injury because a lot of his colleagues rejected this treatment as impossible. When his specialty ward in Philadelphia began to fill up, the Army Medical Department created a dedicated hospital for nervous disease. Hmm. Soldiers flocked to this hospital seeking relief. It was Turner's Lane Hospital, seeking relief from pain that persisted after the wounds had healed. Mitchell described one man so nervous and hysterical from nerve damage that his family thought he was partially insane.
I mean, if it is like nerve pain at the like the root of the injury, like that would be horrific.
Yes. So he started to turn his focus into this area of trying to heal people who've had phantom limb pain. He actually published the Dedlow story anonymously. But he really was labeled as the father of modern American neurology on ghost pain and lingering aftermath of the Civil War.
So he's the first person that really recognized it as some kind of phenomenon.
He didn't discover it like centuries before. I mean, people knew it was happening.
I'm sure it's been throughout history.
Yeah, but nobody really knew what to do with it and often got the psychological angle. And often doctors would ignore patients who would complain because there's no physical cause, right?
They're like, there's nothing there. It's all in your mind. Get over it.
How could there be violent cramping in a leg that didn't exist?
Yeah.
They were trained to look for objective evidence, and so people would get labeled as malingering or faking illness in order to avoid military service.
I think that's one of the diagnoses that I hate, and I wish was out of the DSM.
Yeah, like, really, you have to diagnose someone as faking it?
Like, how do you know? You're not in their fucking body. You're not in their head.
Yeah,
I hate that
one. It's such a stigmatizing, like, I don't believe you diagnosis. Excuse me?
Yeah, nobody should have to prove anything to anybody. Mm-hmm. I hate that one. It's one of many
It's so out of scope of what we do.
Yeah, it's
not horrible.
It's old-timey. It's, you know, that antiquated whole
medical model garbage.
Medical model, European, Freudian garbage pit of stuff.
So the possibility of pain without a lesion, without a wound, challenged the whole basic premise of scientific medicine at the time. Civil War veterans, of course, though, knew that this existed because it was impacting them. Many amputees, although they were sometimes reluctant to talk about it because of skepticism from doctors.
Stigma.
Yes, stigma. There were some records of it, though. One person, Henry Hudecoper, said, of course, as with everybody else who lost a limb, the fingers are distinctly felt, and pain occurs oftentimes to various parts of them. Henry A. Kircher of Belleville, Illinois, also took for granted the pain in his phantom limb. He said, of course it hurts. Mitchell followed up with these patients in the early 1890s, seeking detailed information about ongoing symptoms. One man living in Kentucky described a continuous burning sensation in his amputated feet. He dared not waste money, though, seeing a doctor, unless the renowned S. Weir Mitchell could furnish him with a letter confirming the pain was real. So it was really like you would be dismissed. It would be a waste of money.
And how frustrating and how much hopelessness was, you know, built in those times when you're suffering, you're in pain, and people are like, no, and they brush you're it off. Not.
Like, it's all in your head.
Yeah.
But it reminds me a bit of, like...
But pain is all in our heads. That's what fucking pain is. It's all an illusion anyway.
Well, it's like, it reminds me of pseudo-seizures a bit. Like, just because a medical doctor can't find a reason, a seizure-based reason in your brain for it, doesn't mean you're not having a form of a seizure.
Exactly.
You're having a form of seizure caused by stress.
Nobody knows.
It exists.
And everything. Nobody.
Nobody. Your doctor probably knows Step less back. Than you.
Have a beginner's mind, doctors. That's how I approach everything day to day. Like, how much can I learn from this thing that I think I might know everything about?
Well, and just value human experience and listen to people.
Yes. Don't have that power play. Don't feel like you know better than they know
or
about
else
themselves.
Or you'll end up inseminating them with your own semen.
And your medical license will be revoked, damn it.
But you might not serve jail time because you're a dick.
But don't, like, write on that, Glory.
Mm-mm. Okay. Sorry. Mm. Sorry. Where was I? This one was interesting. So, Henry Huidekoper lost his right hand in the Battle of Gettysburg, and his pain there often started while he dreamt. He said he would write often in his dreams. In 1906, more than four decades after the hand was amputated, he said, "I attempt to use the tendons which would hold and guide a pen." The writing hand, seeming restored, refused to cooperate. Instead, malevolently, the tendons would cramp up and would wake him up in pain from his sleep. Were you going to say something?
I'll save it.
On top of the struggle to find treatment, veterans also had to adjust to disabilities that undermine their sense of self. So losing part of your body feels like some identity loss.
Absolutely.
And that also was taking a toll on them.
Yeah, both. You might feel like you're less than.
Yeah. Physically, mentally, spiritually, your role within your family, not feeling like you can provide. You were military too, so like you were protecting your country and now you can't.
Well, we are 100% an ableist society.
Absolutely. So the problem ended up being that they still didn't have a good solution for what to do. I mean, all this gathering, they still didn't have a good answer. I mean, he even turned to looking towards spiritual like seances to try to summon the ghosts of amputated legs to try to see if that would somehow restore a connection.
I'd try it. I would want to take mine home. Give me my bit.
Mm-hmm,
take it home.
Yeah.
Have a ceremony. I mean, were they given their bits to bury?
I don't know about
that.
Or
do something with? Or
I mean, my guess is they were often probably like blown up.
But still, like, that's rotting. Part of me. I would want it.
I know, but if you're in a battlefield, I doubt.
Right. They didn't bring it with you. They weren't like, let's find the parts.
I mean, you'd be like in pain, passing out from your leg.
No,
they'd
be focused on you not dying.
You wouldn't be conscious enough to be like, grab my leg.
Yeah.
Probably
but
not.
I mean, if possible, I would love to have some kind of closure with those parts of me.
Mm-hmm. He did end up, Mitchell did end up trying at Turner's Lane Hospital to do other types of treatment, including electrical stimulation, re-amputation. Those were rarely effective. As a doctor, he really staked his hope in, like, maybe we'll find a physical cause. Again, medical model here. Maybe we'll find a medical cause so we can help treat and help people.
There's
feel
no difference between mind and body.
But I think back then, too, I mean, we were still very
it's one system.
Separate entities at the time.
Oh, so I shouldn't get angry. This is our Civil War guy still?
Yeah, this okay. is Civil War guy.
Sorry.
He was like the first who took it seriously.
He's cool looking, though.
He is very distinguished.
I like his squint.
Yeah, he's like, I got squint.
I like his eyebrow flares up on the side.
Yes. So I was just kind of surprised to see that, like, back in the Civil War, we're kind of like not that far along. I mean, we have ways of coping, I think, with pain.
But there isn't like, this is what you're going through and this is the treatment.
Yeah. This is what happened. This is why it's happening. And here's the best treatment for you. It's unfortunately like most things right now where it's kind of a guessing game until we find something good enough.
Right.
Which
and
is a bit
different people are trying different treatments, having limited success, varying levels of success.
And this can be chronic for people and lifelong. And I think it's when it gets talked about, it's almost like this casual, like, oh, phantom limb pain. But it's, you know, it's it's a chronic pain that is would be very debilitating. Yeah, yeah.
So, the reason I know anything about this is because I've done a lot of studying of vicarious trauma, and one of the causes of vicarious trauma that I've learned about is a part of the brain that are mirror neurons. So this is a part of the brain that when you observe somebody in pain, you actually in your brain experience that same pain. So it's not like a observing their pain and kind of like an intellectual understanding of it. Like, oh, they're sad. No, you're actually experiencing the same pain. And this is all from V.S. Ramachandran's research. V.S. Ramachandran, please email me. And so what happens with...
I like that on my notepad, you just wrote spontaneous discharges.
Isn't that what you told me to write? I don't... It just makes me think of... the term nocturnal emissions that we learned about in sex ed in fifth grade.
I had a band once called Midnight Release.
Was that what it was about? Same thing?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
So what was I saying?
Mirror neurons.
Mirror neurons.
Yeah.
So V.S. Ramachandran's theory about phantom limb pain is that it has to do with these mirror neurons or these empathy neurons or Gandhi neurons, as he calls them. That normally, like, if something, like, you just, like, hit yourself in the head right now, I'd be like, ooh.
I'm not doing that.
But I would know it wasn't my pain. Yeah. Because I have my head here, and I'd be, there's no feedback loop.
Yeah, yeah.
But say my head was cut off, there's no feedback loop.
Yes, yes,
and so
yes,
I would have that phantom limb head pain forever. And I would have to somehow make a mirror box where there was my head where I could apply a cold compress.
Guess what?
What?
The activity, the experiment that you're going to do.
You're going to make me cut off my head?
No.
Okay.
But what we're going to do, and I'm going to explain it here, and then we'll do her until next time. We'll stop this, but we'll keep recording the video for our best bits if you want to watch how this experiment goes.
And you know you do.
You know you do. So what I'm going to do, though, is I have a separator right there. That's what that weird cardboard box styrofoam thing is. Okay. So that's going to go up in the middle of the table. And
I'm terrified already.
Trusting me is a very scary thing because I literally...
And scary because I trust nobody.
And I literally planned this right before I came here.
And how will my results be used?
Just for public... access
and humiliation.
Okay, so perfect. So the way that this works is you'll have one hand down over here on one side of the box, and then you'll have your other hand on the other side of the box, but you'll only be looking at your right hand, so you won't be able to see your left hand anymore over here. And in the research studies, it's called the rubber hand illusion.
Yes, this is what Ramachandran invented.
Yes,
this.
Yes. Yeah. So that when you, and so that's why I have the paint brushes. When you make the sensation on the hand that you can't see and on the rubber hand, and you're watching the rubber hand have the same movements and the same sensations after 1 to 2 minutes ish, and they said that this happens in about 2 out of 3 people. So
I've always secretly wanted to try this, but not really.
Yeah. So there may be a chance that you don't experience it, but 2 out of 3 do. And what happens is all of a sudden I will stop doing it on your actual hand, but continue doing it on the rubber hand. Oh, and just so you know, I don't have a rubber hand. However, okay, but here's the thing. Research really thought that it relied on this rubber hand, but research shows that especially with hands, we are so used to fluid movement in a space that doesn't exist, right? Like we're okay with actually visualizing a hand that isn't there. It doesn't work with a wood block or an object. Our brain recognizes that that's something different.
Yeah.
But it actually with open space,
because it'll fill it in.
Because of how
the gestalt brain.
Well, and think about this. How often do we use our hands without seeing what our hands do?
No, all the time.
All the time. Yeah. So our brain makes that connection much easier.
Well, you saw that homunculus, the hand part is a huge part of the brain.
Yes. And
so it's very active.
So I thought it was really interesting because everything focused on the rubber hand. And then I read a research study that said the rubber hand was just used, and then it kind of became like, oh, this is what it is causing it, but it wasn't.
Here's the thing, though. In those rubber hand experiences, I've seen experiments. It was a hammer. It wasn't a fucking knife. You made me bring out, I have this giant kitchen knife.
It's because the research, so the research with the invisible hand, bringing out the knife at the end, because like, yeah, in the ones you're, he brings out a hammer and smashes and it scares people. But what they actually did was when they brought out the knife towards the invisible hand, it actually increased the anxiety of the person. And I kind of liked that better than the, because I mean, if you smash a hammer on the table, you're going to get some shock value anyways. I would rather see like how this impacts your anxiety level more than just reaction.
Of course, it's going to be through the fucking roof. I mean,
you're already anxious. It's
all
great,
mental.
Great. Okay, so
and the anticipation of pain is actually the experience of pain.
Okay, so
like that's been shown.
We have to wrap up this part so I can get the experiment ready. So until next time.
If you're going to spank the monkey, you better might as well make some coin.
Okay. And until next time, it's great when it's not creepy. Watch our tidbits.
Tiddlywinks.
Don't watch our tidbits. Watch our tiddlywink best bits to see this experiment happen.